this actually sort of creates a hierarchy that doesn't exist. So saying, okay, one is less serious than the others. And again, if you read the list of crimes against humanity, it's pretty serious. There's nothing not serious about these acts. But also, it considers almost the notion of crimes against humanity as a catch-all category. Like, oh, if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't meet the criteria of genocide, then let's call it a crime against humanity.
Thousands of lives were suddenly ended by evil.
Мною принято решение о проведении специальной военной операции.
The International Criminal Court sentenced former Ugandan militia leader Dominic Ongwen to 25 years in jail.
But news came of the shootings on the island of Utoa.
Across Paris, other attackers detonate their suicide vests.
Bombs explode throughout London.
It was an act of pure evil.
Genocide. That's what Israel is carrying out in the Gaza Strip, according to South Africa. They filed charges at the International Court of Justice in hopes of forcing Israel to stop its military operations against Gaza. But what exactly is genocide, and what are the consequences of qualifying events or mass atrocities as genocide? Are the accusations justified, or is the term used too loosely? And why are political groups not included in the definition? We'll discuss these and more questions in today's episode of Terribly and Terrifyingly Normal. I'm Nicola Kwaadvlieg, and as always, I'm joined by perpetrator expert Professor Alet Smeulers. And today, we're also joined by genocide expert Caroline Fournet. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me today.
Academically speaking, it's quite interesting to be a genocide scholar, I assume.
Yes, that is actually a really good question. There is something fairly specific about genocide studies. It's precisely this, genocide studies. So genocide is an international crime. It's a legal qualification. Yet it is the object of academic and critical analysis by a whole range of different disciplines and not just law. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think we have a field of, you know, an academic field called studies in crimes against humanity. So it's really genocide studies is a field that covers legal studies, but also psychology, criminology, history, sociology. And I'm probably forgetting quite a lot of different disciplines. So in that sense, it is extremely interesting because it is inherently multidisciplinary, if not interdisciplinary. So law doesn't have the monopoly over the analysis of genocide.
Would you say that that is its power?
Yes, because I do think that going beyond the law and into other disciplines is key. It's essential. At the same time, I wonder whether it's not its main weakness as well, to the point that maybe the question can be asked, is genocide a useful legal qualification? And that's probably something we'll discuss more, because the multitude almost of disciplines that do focus on genocide also means that we have a diversity of definitions. And this can be quite detrimental, actually, to at least from a legal and judicial point of view.
Now, the term has been used quite a lot lately by all kinds of people. Alet, do you think people truly understand what genocide is?
Not everyone who's talking about genocide. That is, it is used in different ways and by different people for different purposes. And as Caroline already said, you even meet it at academic conferences when you have genocide scholars or historians talking about genocide. They use a different definition as lawyers would. And now in the public debate, talking about the current events, it's used by people for a specific purpose without necessarily knowing what it exactly entails and what exactly the difference is between genocide and crimes against humanity, for instance.
And what would that purpose be?
The purpose would mostly be to get attention of the world. It is often used as something being the crime of all crimes and to focus how important something is and to trigger this idea of never again having a genocide. So it's used for that purpose.
But is it important for people to have one definition for this term genocide, according to you?
I do think it's very important to be very much aware of its different purposes and to know exactly what the legal definition of genocide is. You can, as a social scientist, use a different definition, but then be clear about it that you use a broader definition than the legal one. So for scientific purposes, social science research, sometimes you have to use a broader definition or a different definition, which is more useful. But then you have to be aware that it doesn't overlap, and you have to be explicit in that and say where it does and it doesn't overlap.
Carleen, would you agree that the legal definition is important for people to know?
Yes, absolutely. And Alette is completely right. I think there is a use of the terminology of genocide, and we've seen it lately quite regularly, actually, in the media. And it's a call for attention. It's a way to alert the world opinion on an atrocity that is being committed, on crimes that are allegedly being committed. And for some reason, the fact of calling in the media an event genocide attracts attention. If it's called crimes against humanity, for some very odd reason, it attracts less attention, although, you know, there's nothing less serious about crimes against humanity. Or less atrocious. Now, the importance of knowing the legal definition, it is of course key, because it is on this definition that responsibility, be it state responsibility or individual criminal responsibility, will be assessed, and not on the other definition. So the courts will use the legal definition with its limitations, with its flaws. But this is the definition that will be used in court. And if a particular event or act doesn't meet the different criteria, the legal criteria for the definition of genocide, then the acts will not be qualified as genocide by the courts.
And what would the legal definition of genocide be?
So definition of genocide include a series of specific acts that must be committed with the intent to destroy an ethnic, national, religious, or racial group as such. That is the definition. So a limited series of acts that target specific groups and that are committed with the intent to destroy this group in whole or in part.
And you just said it has some limitations. So I'm generally curious what those limitations are.
Yes. Well, the first one is one you mentioned actually in the introduction, and it's the issue of the groups that are protected under the Genocide Convention. So the list of protected groups is limited: national, ethnic, racial, or religious. It, I would say, quite famously omits political groups from its ambit. And this is an issue. The reason why we have or why the drafters, let's say, opted for a limited list of groups to be protected was the argument that these groups listed are stable and permanent, and that the idea of the genociders is to target a group that is stable or permanent. But I'm really not convinced by this, because actually in certain and under certain regimes, political affiliation or social belonging could be seen as permanent features of an individual, to the point that these features could be transmitted to other generations. I'm thinking, for example, under the regime of the Khmer Rouge, where political affiliation or social belonging of an individual was seen as a permanent feature of the individual that was actually transmissible to their descendants. So I do think that this fails to convince, and that in a way the perpetrators of genocide will or might create a group that doesn't exist in reality, but they create a group, they assign permanent features to certain individuals, and they decide that all the members belonging to the group, including their ascendants or descendants, will be targeted for destruction. So that's a big limitation for me.
Would you agree?
Yes, I totally agree. And I wanted to add that social scientists have therefore developed the non-legal term politicide, which is exactly the same phenomena as genocide, so the aim to destroy in whole or in part, but then politicide meaning political groups. And for social scientists, it often doesn't make sense to make this difference between genocide and politicide, but legally it's a big difference because a, in quotes, genocide against political groups is not legally seen a genocide. So that might be an interesting thing to know.
And is this debated in the field of genocide studies, whether political groups should also be included in the legal definition?
It was debated at some point, and I don't think it is anymore in a way. And I do think that with the adoption of the Rome Statute in 1998 and then the entry into force of the Rome Statute, in drafting the Rome Statute and discussing the inclusion of the definition of genocide, the drafters didn't change the definition that is embodied in the Genocide Convention. And in a way, I don't know whether this is a missed opportunity or not, but if the definition was going to change, it would have changed then, I think. And I don't know now if there is any sort of appetite to change the definition and include more groups or more acts, actually, than the ones that are listed. And this is something we can also talk about, the different acts. So I'm not sure the debate is as vivid as it was.
It might be interesting to add from a historical perspective where the term came from the Greek genos, meaning race, and the Latin side, meaning killing. And it was developed actually by Ralph Lemkin during the Second World War, because at the time, and Winston Churchill said it nice, it is easier to get away with genocide than it is to get away with murder. So the term, the legal term, didn't exist as such during the Second World War, but was qualified in the Genocide Convention you mentioned in 1948. And maybe for the non-legal scholars listening, the Rome Statute is for the establishment of the International Criminal Court. And that was signed in 1998. So that was 50 years after the Genocide Convention. And I do agree with Caroline that that was a kind of confirmation of this definition without the political groups.
And how important is it to have such a term as genocide? And why are we not just speaking about other kinds of mass atrocities?
Well, we do have other terms, of course, like crimes against humanity, war crimes, and many of the acts that constitute genocide would also probably could be qualified as crimes against humanity and war crimes. But in order to hold someone specifically responsible for genocide, you do need a specific genocide convention. And what I just said about Winston Churchill, that it is easier to get away with genocide than it is with murder, because without a legal definition of genocide, which specifically focuses on the aim to destroy in whole or in part a group, it would come down to a number of individual murders, whereas there's this special intent to destroy a group as such and to not give them feel that they don't have the right to live.
Picking up on the sort of specificity of genocide, it's really about this intent to destroy and what Alette was saying. So, and it goes beyond the actual killing. It's really a crime of destruction. Now, if these crimes are perpetrated against groups that are not protected by the genocide definition, so for example, political groups, they will be qualified as crimes against humanity, because crimes against humanity would cover any crimes, massive or systematic acts committed against any civilian population. So we have this broader sort of category of crimes against humanity. But for these acts that specifically are committed specifically with the intent to destroy one of the protected groups, then it is this intent to destroy that is extremely specific. It's also extremely difficult to prove, and it's what makes the crime of genocide a genocide.
And difficult to prove?
Yes, because the prosecution would not only need to prove the intent to kill, an individual, but rather the intent behind the act to destroy a whole group. So it's not just the individual that is targeted, it's the whole group. And this can be difficult to prove.
And how do courts try to prove this intent to destroy a certain people?
First, they'll have a look at the group. Is one of the group protected targeted? They'll have a look at the different acts and whether the acts sort of meet the definitional requirements. Now, the different acts of genocide are rather broadly defined. There is notably a category of causing physical or mental suffering. So this is fairly broad and can encompass a whole series of different acts. It is, however, in passing, noteworthy that the definition of genocide does not explicitly mention acts of sexual violence. And this was not remedied during the drafting of the statute for the International Criminal Court. We do have case law, notably, well, solely, from the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, with the tribunal recognizing that rape and other acts of sexual violence can constitute genocide when committed with the intent to destroy one of the protected groups. But sexual violence is not mentioned explicitly in the definition of genocide. And this is, of course, I think, hugely problematic.
Why so?
Because even though it seems evident that sexual violence would fall under the category of causing mental or physical harm, it's, you know, we could theoretically imagine a court, for some reason, ruling that sexual violence is not among the acts prohibited and doesn't fall within the definition of genocide. It's difficult to imagine, but theoretically, if the defense proved their case, it could be possible. And it has taken such a long time for acts of sexual violence to be recognized as international crimes, and we're not there yet. You know, we do have the text of the law, obviously, but the practice is still slow, cautious, that I think it was a missed opportunity to actually put it very clearly. Acts of sexual violence can be genocidal acts. So for me, that's another limitation of the definition. But to go back to your definition and the difficulty to prove the intent to destroy, in a way, at the Rwanda tribunal, the prosecution, I would say, didn't have a lot of problems proving the intent to destroy because the crimes had been clearly targeted at moderated Hutus or Tutsis. And that was very clear. There had been incitement, hate propaganda. The level of violence was, I never want to say unprecedented, because sadly history shows us that, you know, violence and human imagination when it comes to cruelty has no limits. But within 3 months, there were between 800,000 and 1 million dead in Rwanda. That's the level of violence we're talking about. All targeted at, you know, one group, as well as moderate Hutus. So the evidence of genocide was fairly straightforward. In the case of the former Yugoslavia and in the case of Srebrenica, the prosecution relied on a lot on the forensic evidence, as well as on evidence coming from historians and military experts to show how Srebrenica had been orchestrated and how all the Bosnian Muslim men of military age had been executed, but also how the fact that only, and I'm putting only in between inverted commas here, only military age men had been targeted for execution in Srebrenica didn't mean that the whole group was not targeted. Rather, it meant that at this stage, the perpetrators felt that if they only targeted military-aged men, they would be able to later on argue that these were combat victims. Because when Srebrenica happened in 1995, the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia had already been created. This didn't stop the perpetrators from committing their crimes. And indeed, when the moment came for them to be answering for their crimes before the tribunal, without exception, they all took the line of defense that was, these were combat victims. And of course, the forensic evidence that was used showed that these were not combat victims, that some of them were blindfolded, that some of them had their hands tied behind their back, and that some of them were actually really young or too old to be actually combatants.
Alet, who eventually decides whether something is genocide?
Ultimately, the judges in the court for which the cases stand or are decided, because they decide legally whether it is genocide and whether they can convict a person for genocide, or in case of the International Court of Justice, whether a state is responsible for genocide. So the ultimate decision is by the judges.
And is that the most important court, the International Court of Justice?
Well, two courts are important. The International Court of Justice is very important for solving issues, debates between states, whereas the International Criminal Court holds individuals criminally responsible for certain crimes, such as genocide. So I wouldn't say one is more important than the other. Both are very important.
Yes, and just to add on this, of course, there's the international level, but there's the domestic level. And more, we see cases of domestic courts actually adjudicating genocide and using what we call universal jurisdiction, i.e. the possibility for them to try crimes of genocide and acts of genocide, regardless of where the crimes were committed, regardless of the nationality of the perpetrator, and regardless of the nationality of the victim. So this idea that the crime is so important that every state has an interest in prosecuting them. And even some states which were rather reluctant in exercising their universal jurisdiction. I'm thinking, for example, of France. France, for a long time, French judges were very creative in finding legal reasons that were far from convincing to refuse to adjudicate cases coming from either from the former Yugoslavia or from Rwanda. And now we see an acceleration of these trials. The last French trial with respect to the Rwandan genocide was actually a judgment issued in December against a gynecologist in Rwanda, and he was condemned for his participation in the genocide, and notably the supervision and control of roadblocks, his support for the government, which had orchestrated the genocide, and the fact that he contributed to held Tutsi prisoners in human conditions before these prisoners were taken to be massacred. And what's interesting here is the fact that I actually believe that the future of international criminal law and justice is probably at the domestic level, that the ICJ and the ICC for individual responsibility are there to almost lead the way. But we now have more and more states which have incorporated the Rome Statute, the definition of international crimes, within their domestic systems. And this empowers domestic courts to adjudicate these crimes. And now international criminal law is becoming part of domestic law, which I think is the way forward to fight impunity. And now international criminal law is becoming, yes, part of the, let's say, usual law. Not so long ago, it wasn't taught at university. And those who created contemporary international criminal law were self-made, coming from public international law, some coming from criminal law, and they sort of created this fairly new legal corpus. But now it is taught at university. Now it is part of domestic law. And hopefully, domestic courts can follow in the steps of the international criminal court.
Alet, do you also see this as a way forward?
Absolutely. I think it's a very important development, and very happy the Netherlands also tries, because the ICC and ICJ are situated in The Hague. The Netherlands also has taken a strong position in trying to prosecute people who are found in the Netherlands. And I absolutely agree, it's a very important development.
But right now, the ICJ and ICC are still very important. And I believe they follow a different definition regarding genocides, right?
No, they don't have a different definition of genocide. They use the same definition. But what might be true, the future needs to show that, and maybe Caroline can say more on that. It might be true that they have a different threshold when it comes to evidence, because the aim of the International Court of Justice is more to use genocide and to prevent genocide. So therefore, the threshold to qualify a case as genocide might be slightly lower. Whereas for the International Criminal Court, the main aim is to hold someone individually criminally responsible for genocide. So then the threshold has to be very specific, and the special intent that we talked before has to be proven in an International Criminal Court. But I'm curious to see if Caroline agrees with that the threshold in the evidence might be slightly different, taking the different aims that the two courts have.
Yes, I completely agree, because before the International Criminal Court, although we have yet to have a case of genocide at the ICC, but the court will be interested in individual criminal responsibility. So in terms of evidence, it will be about showing that this particular individual, the one sitting in the dock, the one accused, had the intent to destroy one of the protected groups. At the ICJ, the situation is different because we're talking about state responsibility here. And in a way, the difference is that if the court recognizes a state responsible for genocide, there is behind, even though this is something almost taboo now in international law, but behind this idea maybe of a collective responsibility of a state as a whole being responsible for genocide, and the impact of this finding could perhaps go beyond the impact of the finding of one individual being responsible for genocide. With the recognition of a state responsibility for genocide, the political impact could be huge. But I'm totally with Alette. And I think what we are seeing with the International Court of Justice is an emphasis on the duty to prevent. So a state has the responsibility to prevent acts of genocide, or to stop acts of genocide if they are committed, to prevent and punish any acts of incitement. So a lot of it is on trying to prevent and stop the genocide, because that is part of the state's responsibility.
So what exactly can the International Court of Justice do to hold countries responsible?
Well, what we saw in the recent cases linked to genocide, be it the situation in Myanmar or the situation in Gaza, both times the court was asked to order provisional measures before ruling on the merits, because cases at the ICJ take a long time. So international justice is slow. So in both cases, the court was asked to order such measures. And in both cases, it did. And it ordered measures asking the allegedly responsible state to prevent and stop any acts of genocide from happening, to prevent and punish any acts of incitement, to preserve evidence of genocide if this is perpetrated, to report to the court on the compliance with the Genocide Convention. So there were, in both cases, this sort of almost immediate, because it was very fast, we're talking a few weeks here, reaction of the court, you know, sort of saying, stop any acts of genocide, if they are committed, just stop them. And this is not very surprising. Again, international justice is slow. The court will rule on the merits. It will take years. Whatever the situation, if there's even an infinite risk that genocidal acts might be committed, it's not very surprising that the court just says, you know, stop any acts of genocide from happening, prevent any acts of genocide from happening, without ruling whether these acts are happening on the ground. That is not what the court is doing at this stage. At this stage, the court is basically recalling international law. No acts of genocide. And then it will rule on the merits.
But does that have any effect?
I would say in the legal sphere, it has an effect. You know, such order from the International Court of Justice, also known as the World Court, is serious. An effect on the ground. I think, you know, states, parties to the Genocide Convention have to act in good faith. So states do have to make sure that they stop and prevent any acts of genocide. Now, whether they will listen to the court is another issue. Now, if the state is not committing acts of genocide, then that will be very clear from their report to the court on their compliance with the Genocide Convention. If it turns out that they are, then according to the court, they should stop. But yes, there is no international police to police states. So at some point, it is about political willingness.
What does make a difference, I believe, is the fact that the International Court of Justice ruled at least in this way, saying we should have provisional measures. As Caroline said, indeed, it doesn't mean that they think there is a genocide, but they do believe there's sufficient cause to say, well, be careful and prevent it. And that might trigger a reaction from Israel, not in the sense that they will stop the bombings, that it was also not required. The ICJ did not ask for a ceasefire, but Israel much more knows that the eyes of the world are onto it and that it has to be careful. And one of the measures I find very good is they have to punish incitement to genocide. So that also makes it clearer, because there are some people in Israel, even in parliament, who made quite extreme statements. And to be aware that these statements cannot be made might help stopping them and might giving a different definition of the situation. So it might help a little bit to at least stop the extent of the massive bombings.
Yeah, because you already mentioned Israel. What exactly are the charges they have against them right now?
Well, the massive bombings, of course, play an important role. That the ICJ said there were about 25,000 deaths, 63,000 injuries, 1.7 million people displaced. So these are very strong indications of an actual destruction. The big issue is there a special intent? Because the intent, Israel argues that it intends to destroy Hamas, which they qualify as a terrorist organization, not the Palestinian people. But yet the violence is so extreme that you can say, well, it ends up destroying a whole group. And would it then be genocide? And the additional aspects are the statements made by certain people referring to human animals. That is a clear example of dehumanization, and also the hate speech. So this combination makes that, yeah, that could be qualified as genocide.
Do you think it will ever get that far?
I'm not sure. It might be very difficult, because the clear intent of Israel seems to indeed be to destroy Hamas, not necessarily the Palestinian people, yet it comes down to a huge destruction. So, yeah, it might be difficult to how they will decide in that case.
Yes, what is also interesting is the qualification of genocide has also been used by Israel and by quite a few people to qualify the acts perpetrated on the 7th of October. And the level here of violence and the acts that were perpetrated that showed an intent to destroy on the part of Hamas, a terrorist organization. So there is also the qualification of genocide has also been used in relation to the 7th of October.
Yeah, and to add to that, Hamas has been more explicit in its aim and possibly genocidal aim, because it explicitly says it wants to destroy Israel. Well, Israel thus includes a national group of Israelis and would thus show the genocidal intent. So as to the intent, there is more.
But is there a case against them?
Not at the ICJ, no. The ICC is looking into the situation right now.
from my perspective, it would seem very easy to then charge them. They say they have a intent to kill the Israeli people and they have already taken measures to do so. Wouldn't that be a very easy case to make?
Well, so not at the ICJ, because the ICJ is concerned with states and Hamas is not a state. It's a terrorist organization. So then we would be looking at the International Criminal Court. If the court decided it has jurisdiction and if the prosecutor wanted to follow this. So yes, there could be a case here with evidence of intent to destroy. The one argument on the part of the defense that I'm going to explain, but I'm going to say I'm not at all convinced about this argument, but I'm just going to say. The definition of genocide talks about intent to destroy a group in whole or in part. What we have seen in the case law and in a lot of scholarly works is in part has been interpreted as meaning in substantial parts. This has been the reason we've seen in the former Yugoslavia to not qualify as genocide a lot of criminal instances committed against the Bosnian Muslims, even though the judges had accepted that the perpetrators had intent to destroy, but the judges felt that the perpetrators didn't have the intent to destroy the Bosnian Muslim in substantial parts. And if you read some of the cases from the Yugoslavia tribunal, a lot of these instances bear a lot of resemblance with Srebrenica, yet they were not qualified as genocide. They were qualified as crimes against humanity, precisely because the judges said the intent was not to destroy the group in substantial part. I'm failing to see the word substantial in the definition of genocide, so I'm not at all convinced. I think all these acts should have qualified as genocide. But to come back to your question about the 7th of October, this could be something a defense might say and might say there was no intent to destroy in substantial parts. Although, as Alet said, we do have some evidence that Israel was there targeted, in which case it could evidence an intent to destroy the group even in substantial parts.
And if the court would rule that it's not a genocide, let's say some years in the future, but instead crimes against humanity, would that then be a win somehow?
This is an interesting question. And it's something that is very often said. Well, because, yes, if an act doesn't qualify as genocide, then chances are it will qualify as a crime against humanity, and crimes against humanity are obviously a really serious category of atrocities. If we read the list of crimes against humanity, there's nothing not serious about any of them. Where I have issue is with the fact that we do have genocide as a specific legal qualification. And if we do have acts committed with the intent to destroy one of the protected groups, then these acts should qualify as genocide. If not, then it does raise the question, why do we have genocide as a legal qualification? Because if the answer is to say, well, if they don't qualify as genocide, they will be crimes against humanity, this actually sort of creates a hierarchy that doesn't exist. So saying, okay, one is less serious than the others. And again, if you read the list of crimes against humanity, it's pretty serious. There's nothing not serious about these acts. But also it considers almost the notion of crimes against humanity as a catch-all category. Like, oh, if it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't meet the criteria of genocide, then let's call it a crime against humanity. And it trivializes the notion of crimes against humanity, while at the same time almost emptying the legal notion of genocide of its meaning. If it's not applicable, then, you know, why have it as a legal notion? So I do think it would still be a conviction, but I wouldn't call it a win if a case, you know, if an act of genocide is not qualified as genocide.
So now what will happen in the future with this case?
Well, the next few months or maybe years, because the ICJ often takes quite a long time for its decisions, it will judge the case on its merits. This was just for the provisional measures. Do we need provisional measures that need to be implemented immediately in order to prevent genocide from occurring? And now they will decide on the case itself, which will take much longer. And yeah, that will be a legal debate, but I fully agree with Caroline. It doesn't make a big difference for the suffering of the Palestinian people in this case, whether or not it will be qualified as genocide. It's basically more or less a legal issue rather than anything else.
And it hasn't been the only case that's going on, also between Russia and Ukraine, right?
Yes, there's another case at the ICJ between Ukraine and Russia, because Russia used the excuse that Ukraine was committing genocide in the Donbas, and that was, for Vladimir Putin, an excuse to invade Ukraine. And Ukraine now raised a complaint versus Russia at the ICJ to let the ICJ establish that there was not a genocide going on, because independent experts, no one has found any evidence of a genocide going on. So that's actually another interesting case, as Russia used this as an excuse.
So is it surprising to you that Russia used genocide and not crimes against humanity as an excuse?
No, it's not surprising. If something is qualified as a genocide, there is a legal obligation to prevent that. So if there would indeed be a genocide, Russia could more or less legitimately say, well, we need to prevent a genocide, and that is why we invade a country. So Putin used that deliberately to give some kind of legitimization of the invasions, and that would be much less so if he would qualify it as crimes against humanity.
And then again, relatively the same question as I asked for Israel. What effect does this have on the conflict, the case at the ICJ?
Not anything directly and specifically, I'm afraid, but it would make it clearer in general to the general world, and maybe unfortunately not in Russia, that the invasion is absolutely illegal. Although the ICJ does not rule on whether or not the invasion of Russia was legal, but whether or not there was a genocide. And a clear qualification by the ICJ that it's not genocide might undermine the legitimization Putin gave for the invasion.
And a final decision hasn't been made yet,
no.
Right? What would the implications of such a final decision be?
It will make it clear that the invasion is illegal, although that is not what the ICJ judges on, but from its judgment, that would be the consequence. But I'm not sure if Caroline agrees on this.
This is out of the, clearly beyond the law, but the psychology of Vladimir Putin, I don't think a judgment would have any consequence whatsoever. I think Russia would be one of these states where a judgment would be very important in the law, very important in even in history. Now, in terms of practical implications, I don't think Putin cares at all about international reputation and the ICJ. What is interesting in his narrative, actually, was indeed the use of the word genocide and the comparison between the Ukrainians and Nazis, and the accusation against the West of being Nazis and or Nazi collaborators. So I think there was a narrative here that was directly inspired from the Second World War, with Putin sort of playing on the outcome of the Second World War, on the legacy of the Second World War, and on sort of having a narrative that Russia was once again victim of Nazis. So I think that's an interesting narrative, but I don't think a judgment would have any consequence on his attitude.
No, I fully agree with that. I don't think for Putin himself it will make any difference. However, in the hopeful event that at some point he will lose power, it will become much clearer that what he did is creating his own reality, because that is the whole thing that he does in Russia, not based on facts, but based on a reality created by them. And many of the Russian soldiers are motivated by these genocide charges because they believe that they are justified to invade Ukraine in order to protect Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And if at some point the regime will fall, then it becomes much clearer, like, look, you were all given a different perception of reality. So I do believe that for the future, it is important, and for the possible second or successor regime to the Putin regime. But I do indeed agree, sadly enough, with you that right now Putin won't care about what the ICJ says.
These are quite big court cases. Do you think they will change the way we qualify genocide?
No, I don't think so. As we said, we have a definition that the crime was defined in the Genocide Convention in 1948. Since then, the definition hasn't changed. And in a way, the cases we have at the International Court of Justice are, in a way, that they're not calling for a very creative interpretation of the notion. What the court will now rule on is whether acts of genocide are being committed, whether there's intent to destroy, whether the state can be held responsible for this. But I don't see any sort of breakthrough, just because I don't think there is necessarily a need for such a definitional breakthrough. In a way, where there could be perhaps more room for, let's say, judicial creativity or interpretation would be in a case involving an individual, because as we discussed as well, the threshold for evidence is a bit different. And then we could have the court sort of adjudicating a particular case differently, perhaps including different acts, or perhaps using new ways of evidencing the intent to destroy on the part of an individual. But we don't have a case yet at the ICC for genocide, so we would have to see this.
I do agree. There is indeed not much chance that the definition of genocide would change, but I do think the fact that we have these two cases at the International Court of Justice is very important, though. I think that's very significant that we have such a court deciding on these issues, and that is, although there were previous cases, but in these two important current cases, is in a way, I would say, a breakthrough. And Israel did accept at least the jurisdiction of the ICJ by coming forward and defending itself. May I ask you a follow-up question, Caroline? Do you think that the fact that the ICJ is now looking into this case, whether Israel's committing genocide, whether there would be more national cases for complicity to genocide for countries that are supporting Israel or providing weapons? Do you think there would be more national cases now as well? Or is that very hard to say?
I think this will be very hard to say. I think also, and this is something that we didn't really talk about, regardless of the court's findings, is the political dimension of the notion. Accusations of genocides and even findings of genocide very rarely attract 100% of support worldwide. And very often they are discussed. In fact, every single genocide is, in the most extreme cases, being denied. We have instances of genocide denial for all the genocides. You know, there's always some discussion around the notion of genocide. And I don't think all states will adhere to the notion, regardless of the court's finding, you know, that Israel is committing acts of genocide or that Hamas committed acts of genocide. There will always be debate and discussion. So I don't know whether a finding at the court would trigger a sudden reaction at the domestic level.
We'll also have to wait and see. That's the unfortunate part of this. We're running out of time, so I want to ask one final question to you both, the same question, and that is, we said at the start that some people consider genocide to be the crime of all crimes. Do you consider the same?
It's a very difficult question. As a legal qualification, it seems yes, because it goes beyond it. On the other hand, the acts on the ground wouldn't matter how you qualify them. They're awful, just the same.
No, I agree. This is a really difficult question. At this very moment, I would say yes, I do think genocide is the crime of crimes. And I might change my mind in about 3 seconds. So it is, Alette is absolutely right. Atrocities are atrocities. And, you know, the issue of the legal qualification in a way is distance from the reality on the ground. On the ground, a rape as an act of genocide or as a crime against humanity or as a war crime is a rape. And the victim is the victim of this particular act. How it is qualified then before a court of law is important. In law, there is no hierarchy as such, but indeed genocide is committed with a very specific intent that makes it distinct from other crimes against humanity. But whether it makes it more serious, that is a question I struggle with. Distinct, yes. More serious,
It is a difficult question. It's a difficult question.
It is a difficult question.
And for everyone at home, maybe think about it yourself, and we'll see if we ever find a solution to this. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us today. And Alette, of course, you as well, as always. And to everyone who's listening, thank you for doing so. And please join us next week, because then we'll talk about trauma in perpetrators. So a very interesting topic. We'll see you next Wednesday.